I would like to introduce today's speaker. Steve Mottemeyer is a senior advisor to the Department of Planning and Development, and he works in development of sustainable strategies for urban infrastructure. And this is probably the big issue facing Seattle right now, is how do we develop more sustainable practices and policies? How do we make more sustainable things that we already have in place? He was the principal author of the Seattle Green Factor, which is a new landscape regulation for Seattle's commercial areas. And so what it does is increase the quality and quantity of vegetation in dense urban areas. He was also involved with Seattle Public Utilities' Salmon Friendly Seattle program, which won awards, to inspire citizen participation in salmon-friendly practices. And Steve is a graduate of the University of Washington in landscape architecture, and it's really exciting to have these successful graduates who go out and do great things and come back and tell you about it. So let's offer a warm, enthusiastic welcome to Steve Mottemeyer.
Thank you, Erin. I am really delighted to be here, and I thank you for actually getting up this morning and navigating through the weather at all. I wanted to talk about just the water center and the whole concept of water, which has really been actually a fundamental thread throughout my entire career. I did grow up in Seattle, went to the University of Washington, and my first job was doing urban design for downtown areas that wanted to redevelop and get kind of their character back. And so I worked a lot with economists and architects to design better city centers and to show how more humane development patterns could be cost-effective and actually make money for the development community. So we would try and talk cities into having better design. And then my next job was working with the Port Gamble-Squallam tribe out on in Kitsap Peninsula. And with the tribe, I helped them start their first environmental program for the tribe itself. And the Port Gamble-Squallam have, in their treaty area, you know, the lands that they released title to, it was about 500,000 acres of the most, a lot of the Olympic Peninsula. And the issues out there, and at that time, growth management was just being considered and started to being implemented. So the tribe and the tribes that were signers of that treaty had a huge amount of natural resources that they retained ownership in. And the whole point of, particularly with salmon and shellfish, has to do with, is there water? Can the salmon get to their habitat? Is there water there? What's the quality of water with shellfish and things? And so, see, Steve here, who also worked there. Anyway, that was a huge, big lesson for me about the interconnectedness of how we manage our landscapes, both for forestry, road building, and development, and the impact on the natural environment. And, of course, water is the thread that moves through all of it. And one of the projects that I worked on for the tribe was the Dungeness-Quilcene Watershed Plan, which was one of the first statewide-sponsored watershed plans in the state. And that was 3 years of driving to Port Angeles, or SWIM, actually, every other Tuesday night for 3 years. And besides the great road time, it was really enlightening to both learn about what was really driving all the issues and also to learn where people were coming from. So that watershed planning, you end up kind of negotiating a strategy that you think will work. And I'm actually really proud of what we came up with, although implementation has been spotty, because once we left kind of the confines of our watershed group, it was hard to get the state legislature or others who weren't part of it to kind of buy into the agreed outcomes. But that ended up getting me a job for the city of Seattle for the water department, because the state was just about to expand into central Puget Sound and look at watershed planning on the Green and the Duwamish River, on the Cedar, Lake Washington, the Snohomish. And so I represented the city in those three efforts as they were just kicking off, and then kind of helped build within city government the teams that worked on those watershed plans. And I'm spending a little bit of time on this before I start, because I wanted to kind of create what the linkage between what I'm doing now and what I did then. And one of the key events for me during the Snohomish watershed planning effort was taking a helicopter flight with some elected officials over the watershed. And we were going about 100 miles an hour over the land. And it was maybe 30 minutes of just driving over or flying over. And we weren't that high up, maybe I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 feet. And you're looking down at the landscape, you know, kind of a landscape ecology, look at the pattern on the land. And I was realizing that each one of these landowners was making profound decisions about the fate of that watershed. And they weren't making it in a watershed context. They were making it into what they thought was the right thing to do with their land. And that really, for me, pointed out that how people think and how they feel and what they think is right has a huge impact on what we really end up with. And I can do all the best planning in the world, but if the people out in the watershed really don't quite get it, or if their culture doesn't help them get it, then it's going to be really hard to kind of get the outcomes that we want, which of course is, you know, clean water, and healthy wildlife, and a good, charming life. So that then really got me thinking about, well, how do we look at the world, and how, what is it that frames the way that we walk around the world, and how do we make good decisions that just automatically create better outcomes? And one idea would be that we would just train everyone in, say, in Washington State to be a biologist and really or an ecologist and understand how all that works. And then the other way would be to just make it part of our culture that we tend to make the right decisions. And I think about who changes the way culture thinks. And, you know, and I think about advertising. And I was thinking about how many brochures has Coca-Cola handed out. And I don't know that they've ever handed out a brochure. But they definitely have totally permeated our culture. So they have done it because they have basically invested in the tools to get people to think about the world in a way where having a cola seems like a really rational thing to do at any given moment. Or at least it's within the context of things to do. And a lot of the decisions that we make about managing our water and our landscapes maybe are also marketed away from an outcome that you really want. So not only do we need to have good science and understand how these systems work and have good restoration strategies about how to intervene in them to give better outcomes and to monitor those and to change over time, we also need strategies about how we think about the world and how we make decisions as individuals. And so social marketing is kind of one of those key strategies that really can, it's basically using the skills that marketing and the tools that marketing has to get outcomes that benefit all of us as opposed to benefit someone's bottom line on their particular narrower interest. So the salmon-friendly Seattle was a lot about linking social marketing with good practices on the ground. And salmon-friendly Seattle was a five-day charrette where we brought experts from all over the country. And we each gave them five sites in the city, and we said, okay, and we had a bunch of students that were on the teams to kind of help populate the teams. And we said, how would design in these places change if we were trying to actually make sure that there was habitat for salmon in the city? And this is the city where there's all kinds of people who have made all sorts of decisions on a much finer grain than Snohomish County, parcel by parcel. But it's also a place where salmon are literally still trying to swim in and out. And sometimes when they swim in, like in Longfellow Creek, they literally die when the first rainstorm hits them because of all the pollutants that come flushing down. So what are the strategies that we use? So we looked at the waterfront where the sculpture garden is now. And one of the proposals was the little bay that you see there. We looked at a school and a playfield. We looked at a residential area. And two others, or the Arboretum and one other one I'm liking on. Anyway, what happened to me was another one of those. It was like my helicopter flight where something came on. And two of the key people were Andy Lipkis from Los Angeles, was one of the team leaders, and also Patrick Condon from the University of British Columbia, the sustainability chair. And Pat said to me, you know, we're changing your whole life in the next 5 days. And he was right, because they really taught me and the rest of us, you know, a bunch of the tools that you can implement in a dense urban area to really look at water in particular in a whole new way. And those are things like rain gardens, which now aren't necessarily a new idea, but are much a part of the toolkit that we now use. It was things like what we're now calling either natural systems, drainage systems, or low impact development. It was a lot of those kinds of strategies. And the basic concept was that you want the You want every bit of the urban infrastructure working on behalf of your environmental outcomes. You can't just say, well, that's a road, that's trash, you know, we're just going to protect the park and then hope that somehow it's all really going to work. It really, every piece has to be working. We need working roads that produce cleaner water. We need working sidewalks. We need, you know, our parks need to do more than just be the place where we do some things and other things. We need the whole city to be reinforcing our goals and outcomes. And that's hard to do. And so I worked for the water department, which became Seattle Public Utilities. And when it became Seattle Public Utilities, it got the sewer and drainage elements woven in, as well as solid waste issues. And I was lucky enough to work in the director's office and kind of have the opportunity to look at how they all fit together. And so Salmon Friendly Seattle was part of that. But then about a year or so ago, it was actually maybe almost two now, I was basically trying to invent a job for myself. And I went to the head of the finance department, which is Dwight Dively. And I said, you know, we have green building, which is the buildings, and we're really doing really well as a city on that. But if you look at everything else but the buildings, there's a whole lot going on. And so I talked him into giving this a shot. And the reason that I went to Dwight Dively is because he's the guy that's in charge of the money. And so now I'm going to start with my slides, because now we've kind of brought the story up to the basic issue here, which is the land and how we treat it, how we think about it, and the money. And that's the two pieces that I'm going to link together. Are there any questions about that so far? So are we getting the results we want? Are we getting a more delightful city? Are we getting cleaner water? Are we getting more salmon habitat? Are social and are we getting better transit? We have a comprehensive plan. I work now for the Department of Planning and Development, which is a land use entity. Our comprehensive plan is called Towards a Sustainable Seattle, or Toward a Sustainable Seattle, and it was adopted in the late 80s, I think, or early 90s. So we had the idea we wanted a sustainable Seattle, but, you know, are we really getting there? And, you know, I would say we are, but, you know, we're way shy of truly being there. And this is one of the key points I wanted to raise, is that when you work in a watershed planning or salmon restoration strategies, there's a bunch of tools that we take for granted in that field that really need to and ought to apply to the way we manage urban lands. So we have like urban designers and architects and road engineers who don't know anything about watershed planning, and they don't really understand those principles. And like one of them is, in a natural setting, you have a natural system is, you know, at any given moment, like if you just parachute down and land on a stream somewhere, and you look at the stream, you can predict, you can tell a lot about that whole watershed by just what shape that stream is in, by the cobble size, by the plant. You know, you can know a lot about the past because you've got a snapshot of this system in motion. So natural systems are multiple systems in motion, and you can take a slice at any point and you can backcast what happened to that watershed. Well, the same thing in cities when you're doing urban design. You can parachute into an intersection and look at it, and you can backcast in a lot of the same way, and you can also intervene in that system with a restoration point of view to change the trajectory of that system. And you could do that for human health, you could do that for safety, you can do that for water quality, livability. So a lot of those watershed strategies really need to be thought about in the urban context and in these other kind of urban design fields. So when you look at the city, the city itself owns a third of Seattle. And that's if you add up all our roads and our utility rights of ways and our parks and our city properties. And that's 24 square miles of the densest urban land, you know, probably north of San Francisco. And our strategy for managing that is no strategy at all, because we manage it by department. But one of the things that we do to getting the money is that we spend $650 million a year to manage that land. And that all goes... Actually, this map was done in salmon-friendly Seattle days, and the idea was, can we identify where everybody's spending money over the next 6 years? And then the theory was, can we find clusters of money spending and then, integrate better? But when I looked at this pattern of spread across the landscape, it reminded me of rain in the summer when it's really dry and dusty and those first big raindrops start splotching down. It was this kind of semi-random splotching pattern across the entire landscape of the city. And this is where the money falls to the ground every year, $650 million. And so the concept there was maybe we can start directing the way that that money falls to the ground to get better outcomes. So the basic idea is, can we manage that land as an integrated urban ecosystem that provides mobility, open space, recreation, habitat, and aesthetics? Can we have an integrated outcome that we want from that land? And then can we bring tools? Can we use asset management and triple bottom line tools? And I'll explain those. Here was one of the key things I wanted to make, is that we tend to spend the money in the city by a silo perspective. So if you're in the transportation department, your job is to go fix a, not a pothole, but, you know, to fix a bad intersection. And so you go and you work with your boss and the people that you work with, and then you come up with your problem, and then you, what the city of Seattle calls a BIP, which is a budget issue paper, you write an application for funding, and it goes, you send it over to the finance department, and every year they get about 800 of these BIPs that come in, and then they evaluate the BIPs, and then they say, okay, these are going to get funded. It goes to the city council, then they kind of bless it, maybe tweak it a little, but then you end up doing the project. And so every year there's this incoming of 800 and some BIPs. They get evaluated and done. But that person fixing that intersection doesn't need to talk to Seattle Public Utilities about drainage issues or the land use entity, et cetera. And so the basic idea here was that of that $650 million, if we had a better process for cross-fertilizing the way we think about projects, maybe we could get more value for the money that we spend to meet that broader objective of a livable urban ecosystem. And what I found is that a lot of times these decisions are made within the context of the department, and they don't even really have the expertise or even the encouragement to think about the alternatives. One example that's just not the best example, but one was that Sono Hashisaki, who some of you know, was doing a project where she was building a trail or designing a trail, and the community, the neighborhood, had put together a basketball hoop that, and a little court that was right where the trail was. And our engineers and project managers would not accommodate that basketball court because it wasn't in the design, it wasn't in their budget, and they didn't have time to deal with it. And so they just plowed it away. And that's the kind of losses that you get when you only have your job is take this project, get it implemented, and don't think about anything else. And a lot of times we get that way as a city, because we either don't have the expertise and we certainly don't have the encouragement to be thinking more broadly. So one I'd mentioned was the triple bottom line tools. And one of the key things is that when you're doing, even within your line of business, like if you're trying to fix that intersection, you might look at two or three different alternative ways to fix that intersection. But they will be pretty much within the kind of world that you normally deal with. They won't be totally off-the-wall things like, do we even need this intersection? Or what if we made it a park instead? Or what if we just did this crazy drainage project there at the same time that would really, you know, add huge value? You don't even think of that. So you might look at alternatives, but you're not thinking of those others. So one of the things is, if we bring a little bit of rigor to the alternatives identification, there's the chance to for some more integrated projects to make it through the funding stream. So, one of the things I'd mentioned was asset management. And asset management is a tool that's kind of coming out of the water business in particular, but it's not only in the water business. But it's basically saying if you know what your assets are and you know what condition they're in, then there's tools that you can use to manage them better and to have and more efficient use of those resources. And Seattle Public Utilities is a national leader in adopting asset management strategies. And they have saved well over $150 million by using asset management. So let me give an example from their own work. Up on Finney Ridge, there's a bunch of, I think it's 20 or 30 houses that have continuous low water pressure. You know, you turn on the faucet and it just dribbles out instead of coming out like it should. And the utility looked at it and they said, well, you know, we need to put in a new pump station because we're supposed to deliver at least 20 pounds per square inch everywhere. And so we need a pump station. And that was going to be about $1 million. So they had taken in this asset management strategy, which said, look at more alternatives than you would have otherwise. And they looked at, well, one thing we can do is put little booster pumps in the basement of each house. So we'd have 30 little booster pumps. But those little booster pumps, they only last 5 or 10 years. Whereas if we put in that big honking $1 million pump, you know, it'll be there for 50 to 100 years. So the rule of thumb when you were in the utility at the time was it's way better to spend a bunch of money on something and not have people running around taking care of it than it is to have people running around taking care of things. Because once you hire somebody, they want a job for their whole life, and it just seemed like it would cost too much. But asset management said, let's look at the full cost of that improvement over the life of the project. So they looked at the $1 million pump, and then they said, what's it going to cost to maintain that? And they stretched it out over 50 years. Said, well, that's what this is going to cost. And then they looked at those little tiny booster pumps in the 30 houses and what it would cost to replace them constantly and mess with all the homeowners, and it was way cheaper to do the booster pumps and hire people than to buy a big pump from somewhere else. And the only reason it was way cheaper was because they looked at the full cost over the full life. And then what you do is then you bring it up to a net present value. You can kind of compare apples to apples to apples for projects that have different lives and different operations and maintenance costs. And so it's a way to kind of rationally look at what your choices are. So this kind of tool of looking at your alternatives can also be applied, again, even more broadly, beyond the water business, but also to transportation and parks and land use decisions. And we can start looking dollars to dollars to dollars, apples to apples to apples comparisons at a broader range of alternatives if we take the time to think about them and to give them enough credence. So that's the basic concept. Have a sustainable strategy as your background concept. When you are spending money, look at a broader range of alternatives. When you look at that broader range, do the math so that you can compare them to each other over their full lives. And then the theory is you'll make more improved decisions, and I think that it's going to be the case. So one of the ways that you look at alternatives is you say, do we spend more money or do we do O&M? That's the first one. Another one is centralized or decentralized. And this is where low impact development, natural drainage strategies really shows its stuff. The centralized strategy is that you build big pipes and then you get rid of the water and you get it out into the bay or the lake. The centralized strategy is you have a big sewer plant at West Point, and then you have big sewer pipes running everywhere, and as fast as you can, you get all that liquid out of town. The centralized strategy costs a bundle of money, Brightwater, a new plant up in Snohomish County. I think it's $1.8 billion. About half of that cost is just to put in the pipes underground, so it's like $800-900 million. To dig holes in the ground to convey the water off-site. So those are centralized strategies. Decentralized strategies are deal with the water that you've got when it comes down to you. So if it rains on your parcel, can I use it on-site? Can I treat it on-site? If it's wastewater, can I treat it on site? Can I minimize the amount that I spend just for conveyance, just for to distribute it? And so that's where decentralized can work. So maybe 40% of the money that you spend for centralized systems is to move it. So that's 40% that you can now spend on treating it on site if you're trying to do a decentralized strategy. And what's emerging right now, I would say internationally, is a better understanding and awareness that we need we need to have both of these working together. Where we have centralized systems, we maintain them. When we need to improve them or add to them or update them, maybe we don't add more centralized, maybe we add decentralized and we nest it in. And that's really a huge emerging area, and in part because the centralized strategies haven't been working that terrific. They're exceedingly expensive, and they still end up often pumping out polluted water the other end. And if you never took into account the value of clean water or the cleanest possible water, you know, if it's an external cost, then you, which is kind of our typical drainage system, you know, the cars and trucks and buses dump stuff on the road. We get it into the pipe, we get it off to the bay, and then we don't worry about it until we have the Puget Sound Partnership say, gee, this isn't working. So if you have a decentralized strategy, you do things like C Street, which is, you know, a rain garden, vegetated swale up in North Seattle where 98% of the water never leaves the site. So even if it were polluted, you wouldn't know it from Puget Sound's point of view. And it may not even be polluted, or if it is polluted, it may be getting treated on site through biological and other means. So the mixing of decentralized and centralized is a key element that in a way is Seattle Public Utilities is taking on fairly well, especially on the drainage issue. They're less willing to go there on the wastewater side, but you could just as easily do that. You can put a membrane bioreactor in the basement of your building. In fact, there's 30-story building in Portland, where there's another one in several in New York City, Solaire, where the toilets flush, they go down to this membrane bioreactor in the basement. It treats it up to tertiary levels, or suitable for irrigation. And then they run that water back through to flush the toilets again, and then the output is extremely small compared to a normal building. So anyway, those are decentralized. Do you do it with one department, or do you collaborate? Do you do the normal way we've always done streets, or do you do the green version? Do you, in the case of Seattle's water system, and when I first started working for the city of Seattle water department, they were looking at building a new dam on the North Fork because their projection said we would be out of water by 2003. And they had just adopted the strategy to conserve instead. So conservation is called demand management. Supply enhancement means you go build a new dam. You can do the same thing with transportation, with water supply, with wastewater, etc. So that's the idea. What we're proposing is that you link sustainability, asset management, and triple bottom line. And instead of doing the silos of by department, where every decision is made internally and then goes to the mayor's office, we're saying, can you broaden the alternatives when they're evaluated before they go in, and then can we do more robust analysis before it goes into the mayor's budget? And so we've identified half a dozen projects, and I'll just mention, let me just mention this one, the Seattle Center Water Swap. That's Seattle Center. It's 73 or 74 acres. This is Lake Union up here, and that's Elliott Bay down there. I-5 is right on basically on the edge of this map. So this is the Mercer Street off-ramp, which kind of ends, well, I guess right here. Right here, underneath the ground, is a combined sewer overflow pipe, which is, I don't know, it's like 10 or 12 feet in diameter. And its whole job is when it rains, like today, all the water that's here on all the streets and all the buildings and everywhere flows into this pipe where it's stored for treatment later at West Point Treatment Plant. So this pipe, you know, in August when it hasn't rained for a month, is probably fairly empty. But when a huge big rainstorm comes, it can fill all the way to the top or even overflow. But the idea is that it can control overflows that might otherwise be happening at West Point. And that's sewage that's barely treated before it goes out, just primary treatment. So Seattle Center sits on top of this. Now this is under the ground, like I don't know how many feet, but maybe 100. I'm not sure how deep. The Seattle Center is 74 acres, and all of Seattle Center is a separated system, meaning the rain that falls on the Key Arena or on any of the grounds goes into stormwater pipes, and then it goes to the edge of the property, and then it drops into the sewer and becomes sewage the instant it goes in. So it starts as rain, it kind of becomes stormwater, then it becomes sewage. Well, this pipe is sized to include all this land to drain in. And so it does, it gets treatment. But it's also, if you think about it, it's probably the cleanest 74 acres, or pretty close to the cleanest we have in Seattle. There's no arterials on it, there's no industry on it, it's just buildings and lawn and vegetation areas. Meanwhile, right here is I-5, which drains uncontrolled into Lake Union. So that's probably the most polluted stormwater we've got, and it has no control on it at all in Lake Union. We have a couple hundred acres of Capitol Hill that flow into Lake Union as well. Right here, just a block and a half away. Same thing, all these very busy arterials are part of our densest part of the city. No treatment, straight into Lake Union. So one of the things that SPU is looking at is building something that's been called the swale on Yale. It has a different name now. But it's basically a vegetated swale for three city blocks, and it'll treat about half of this stormwater before it gets into Lake Union and make for cleaner water, and that's a really good thing. But it's only going to treat about half because of the size constraints. So here was the theory. How much of Seattle Center, if we redevelop it, can we remove from the combined sewer overflow? And then let's put the equivalent amount in from Capitol Hill. Let's put polluted water in and keep clean water out. And the way to keep clean water out is to do rainwater harvesting. There's over 3 million gallons of water a year that comes off Key Arena. That water, and what does Seattle Center use water for? They have toilets, they have irrigation, they have the food circus, you know, which is a very small amount of potable water use. The majority of their water probably goes for non-potable purposes. Seattle Center spends $400,000 a year buying water and treating and paying for sewage of that water, and maybe half of that doesn't need to be done because they could just take the rain that they're getting and then reuse it to irrigate the lawns or to be the fountain or whatever. So as they're putting together their strategy to go out and look at redevelopment of Seattle Center, we're saying how much of this sort of rainwater harvesting decentralized strategies can we implement on the campus and then put bad Capitol Hill water in as a replacement. Seattle Public Utilities is spending kind of something like $50,000 an acre for this swale, meaning that, you know, that's, they're going to treat about half of it. It's going to be about $50,000 an acre. So we said to SPU, we want your $50,000 for every acre we can pull out, but we'll spend it on water features or rainwater harvesting systems instead of swales. And SPU has been open to that idea. So that's one of the ideas, green up the Seattle Center, and there's energy and lots of other things that can happen there, but just on the waterfront, this is taking advantage of centralized infrastructure, nesting in decentralized, and then doing interdepartmental swaps, because Seattle Center wasn't thinking about sewers at all, and SPU wasn't really thinking about Seattle Center that much, but by bringing them together, you get an outcome, a higher benefit outcome. I think I'm going to wrap it up there because it's. But maybe what we could do is just ask questions or have a conversation for the next 15, 20 minutes. Yes?
Well, I've heard a lot of talk from some engineers that they don't quite envy from the hospital to give that much infiltration in Seattle because of all the glaciers. So I was just wondering what your perspective was on that.
Yeah.
So the question was on how much infiltration is really possible in Seattle and given some of these strategies. Well, when we did the Salmon Friendly Seattle thing, we had heard that as well. And so we did soil tests at every single one of the five sites, and they all perked better than the maps said they would. It doesn't mean that it's always going to work. But it's not... Infiltration is just one of the kinds of strategies. Another one could be that you just delay the flow on site with a vegetated swale, so it slows up and then it slowly comes out and can be handled by the normal system. Another option is you just have a huge big tank like at the Coliseum, and you just store that water and then you just use it for evaporation or irrigation, which has nothing to do with infiltration. So infiltration is one piece. You definitely have to design appropriately. And you don't want, for instance, infiltration on landslide areas of the city. So there's places where it's not appropriate. There's places where there's polluted subsoils. You don't want it. But in places where it works, it needs to be evaluated as one of the options. Yeah?
You started out by talking about Coca-Cola. And
yes.
Engaging the public. How was your office or your position engaging stakeholders to kind of get them behind these changes to kind of reach a critical mass?
Mm-hmm. And the question is, how are we doing social marketing with this sort of effort? And we're not yet, but that doesn't mean that it's not kind of all happening anyway. One of the things that happened a couple of years ago that some of you may be involved with was the Open Space 2100 design charrette. And this was where there were about 300 people who came together for, I think it was two or three days. And they designed a 100-year open space strategy for the city of Seattle. And they created this incredible map of all the potential linked open spaces that we could have in the city. And then they walked up to the mayor and the city council and they could say, here's your 100-year strategy. Please implement this. And the elected official said, gee, thanks. What do we do with this? And part of it is, what do you do with it is that it was put together by some people that knew a lot about what they were doing, some folks who didn't, and with not a lot of, real on-the-ground, like we didn't have perk tests for all of these sites, and we didn't really know the ownership or the, to kind of go from, here's the idea, we could have incredible linked open spaces, we could have, like neighborhood districts that were self-supporting with their, catching solar, using rainwater harvesting, highly walkable, generating their own food. These were some of the ideas that came out of that. And so they had developed this kind of vision for the city that really needed to be, in a way, professionalized by the city so that they could figure out how to adopt some of these things as they made sense, both economically and with the reality on the ground. And so part of my job last year was take the Open Space 2100 and use it as one of the alternatives generators when we're looking at projects. And give it a real look and see if we can implement some of these things in the near term or in the longer term. So that was the public part that kind of happened on its own in a way with obviously help from the university and many others that came into the city. A lot of the work that I'm doing right now is deep inside the bureaucracy, working on the inside, trying to rearrange the way that money flows through the system and decisions get made. And I've likened it to moving the pyramid over half an inch. It's like the once it's a government is a really stable entity, but if you could move it half an inch to start churning out more sustainable outcomes, that'll really pay dividends as the years go by. So at the moment, a lot of it's internal, but there are, I think as some of these integrated projects start coming out, it'll start manifesting in the public more. In the back?
Yes, I kind of like to challenge some of what it is that you're speaking about here
sure.
today. For example, Seattle Public Utilities did a workup on 34th Avenue West on Magnolia. It was part of the developing parking strips that could turn into alternatives like the water gardens and mm-hmm. the swales and all that kind of thing. However, you had extreme buy-in on the part of the neighborhood people. But two things. One, we were told that was just something that SPU was trying out and wanted to see how it worked. And then the second part is that there was no funding for that. And I kind of have been sitting here listening to you, and it sounds to me that SPU is good at generating initiatives, so to
think those are really good points. And I think you mostly heard, but I'll just briefly repeat it, that there was a nice project on 34th West in Magnolia looking at ways that we could treat parking strips, but the message came back, despite community support, that it wasn't in the budget. And then the bigger question is, we have all these great ideas, but is the money really there? And an example was given of a settlement with the Muckleshoot tribe where we seem to have plenty of money for that. And how does that all fit together? The city, I think it's like about $30 million a year is what the city spends on drainage. Maybe it's $40 million, somewhere in that range. If you went citywide and said, what would it take to clean up everything in the city, I bet it would be hundreds of millions, if not even more than that. So we have literally kind of a drop in the bucket to deal with the demand out there. And one of the ways that the city makes decisions, or Seattle Public Utilities, about what to prioritize is based upon what has been identified as an issue and how does it fit into the budget. So you'll in any given year, you'll have your, let's say it's $40 million to spend, but then you've got your out years, you know, up to 6 years where you've kind of got things kind of in holding pattern come in. And so when you're managing the drainage utility, for instance, you're saying, okay, these are the near-term issues and what are the longer-term, and so there's this trajectory of projects that get lined up and then come in to get implemented. If we did them all at once, you know, we would blow our budget. So one of the things that we're trying to do, and we are, I would say, at Seattle Public Utilities, at least on the drainage front, is we are integrating in these concepts that otherwise never would have been in. 10 years ago, there was nothing like any of these things happening. But we still had a drainage utility. But they weren't doing any of these kinds of green things, and they weren't even looking at them. So it is a transition over time. One last reference to your comment is about the Muckleshoot settlement. And there's two pieces to that. One is, I was involved in that, and I used to work with the tribes, as I mentioned. And, you know, when tribes signed a treaty, they basically signed an agreement with the U.S. government, and they said, we're not going to go to war with you, but we're going to let you own the land in reserve. We want to retain our rights to hunt and fish in our usual and accustomed places. So retained rights is the kind of the key word there. And the Muckleshoot basically sued the city and the National Marine Fisheries Service and said that the way that Seattle was managing our water supply was limiting their access to their rights. And it's much more complicated than all of that, but the upshot was that the city and the tribe entered into negotiations to come up with a long-term solution that met all their interests over time. And if you think about Seattle's water system, it's over 108 years old, I think, 107 years old, and it'll probably be there another 100 years, and of course the tribes are here from time immemorial to time in the future. So we really are having centuries-long agreements that we need to agree to, and so I think that there was completely a rational reason why that agreement made sense. One last thing is that one of the complications to doing this integrated thinking is enterprise funds, which means that the money that you raise, like for water supply, can only be spent on water supply. You can't spend that on transportation or drainage or parks or anything else. And the same with drainage funds. They're limited by the legislature, and when they allow you to raise the money, what you can spend it on. So that's one of the key pieces that's kind of happening behind the scenes, is negotiating with the transportation department and the drainage department and the water supply and the wastewater people which parts they can actually pay for within the confines of that enterprise fund, and then crafting agreements and finding new money if there's a gap between in order to do an integrated project.
I think it was in December the mayor announced the completion of a State of the Waters report. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty comprehensive evaluation of the condition of the five major streams and within the confines of the city boundaries. And from that, that would seem to provide a pretty good opportunity to sort of prioritize the specific actions that could be implemented to sort of recover some of the water quality and other values. Have you guys sort of integrated that yet into your planning?
So is the mayor's State of the Waters report... Have we integrated some of the priorities that were identified in that? And I'm personally not working on that. That's, you know, Miles Mayhew is dealing with that. And so I'd say the answer is no, as far as I know. Certainly the whole point of the work that I'm doing is to figure out how to identify these priorities that various departments or people have and then integrate them into the way that we prioritize spending. But I don't have any near-term action on that.
I guess, so looking at your kind of stovepipe or your silo diagram, how is your piece of this process going to work? Are you like a bureaucratic layer in between kind of the silos and the mayor's office? And how do they feel about that? And just kind of how does the sort of practical implementation of that work?
So briefly, if we're really trying to implement across, is it a new layer of bureaucracy that kind of makes it hard? How do you really implement this? And maybe the answer is yes, but what I'm trying to do is to change the way that we evaluate projects by the financial department, and where we'll say, well, have you looked at all these alternatives? Have you used this more robust analysis? If you have, then great, your project's going to go in. If you haven't, then we're going to say, go back and do that further analysis. So it's not so much that me or the people I work with are the new yes-no people. It's can we change the process and inform people to have a more robust analysis when they do come in for funding.
Let's thank Steve Mahler for that.